Great. So I'm really sorry to end your wonderful morning with cosmology, but it might be wonderful in its own way. We'll see. So how are things? So what are the puzzles on your mind about cosmology this beautiful morning? Any questions from yesterday or yesterday morning or yesterday afternoon? So we discussed the thermodynamics in the early universe a little bit, but very hastily. So, and we don't really have much time to do it. It's kind of interesting that on the one hand, the thermodynamics in the early universe is very well understood. At least parts of it where we understand the physics, we understand where we know with the fundamental physics, we can do the calculations relatively easy. But then it's also kind of messy. There are so many different phases. So I cannot, I'm neither expert enough nor have the time to cover all these different processes. But I wanted to draw for you a timeline, and I've been wondering where is a good place to draw it. Maybe somewhere here. For the kinds of processes that we think are happening in the early universe as we go to early times. So let's call this the era. Basically, the name of the process that's happening at the particular time. And cosmologists would like to describe everything in terms of temperature, because temperature basically tells you the kind of processes that are allowed to happen. Because, I mean, for example, the high energy processes, they happen at high temperatures, but at low temperatures, they don't, right? And vice versa, there are processes that only happen at low temperatures, but at high temperatures, but not at high temperatures. And we also learned over the course of this week that this temperature is inversely proportional to A, the expansion factor, which is, again, inversely proportional to redshift. So if you know the temperature of a process in Friedmann cosmology, you know what its redshift is. So the earliest thing that cosmologists can at least semi-intelligibly talk about is inflation. And that semi-intelligibly is a very, very generous word, actually, because we don't really know much about it. This could happen somewhere between energies of 1 TeV to 10 to the 15 GeV. And exactly what is happening is also very, very ambiguous. Now, but we know that we need a period of exponential expansion. But when it happens or when it ends, it could be any temperature in this range, which is a very large range. Something else that we need to happen in the early universe, but we don't know exactly how it happens. So the inflation, as I told you, we needed to happen in order to solve the horizon problem. So why is the universe so homogeneous on larger scales? The other one is baryogenesis. Basically, the question of why we have more baryons than anti-baryons. So it seems that so this also happens somewhere in the similar temperature range, probably sometime during or after inflation. But again, we don't know exactly when it happens. The end state of baryogenesis is supposed to be what we observe today. The number of baryons to the number of photons should be roughly 10 to the minus 10. Now, if you had exact baryon symmetry, baryons and anti-baryons were exactly treated the same in the early universe, which Well, I mean, which seems reasonable, at least in thermal equilibrium, that's what you expect. Particles and antiparticles are effectively the same. They have the same energies, they have all the same properties. Then this would be zero. The net number of baryons would be zero, and when everything annihilates at a late time, you don't have any baryons left. But right now, we seem to have lots of baryons in the universe and very little antibaryons. So that's what baryogenesis is supposed to do, but we don't really know what process in particle physics would lead to this. The process that we know cannot. So if you go then far to lower temperatures, somewhere around 100 GeV, then physics is a little bit better understood. Essentially, that's the course that you've been having just before mine. That's the standard model of particle physics. And that seems to be a good description of high energy phenomena around this temperature or this energy and lower. So people talk about electroweak phase transition at this point. So have you guys heard about Higgs? Higgs, well, you have. Who have you heard it from? Francois? Debbie, okay. So that was a while ago, right? Or recently?
A few weeks ago,
okay. So you know about the Higgs potential, right? So it seems to be one scalar field in a standard model, which hasn't been observed, so it's probably the most questionable part of a standard model. But still, it seems to be there and necessary to make the theory consistent. And one thing about the the Higgs boson is that it seems to be sitting in a minimum, which is different from the point of maximum symmetry. So the point of maximum symmetry is here on top of this potential, but where the Higgs seems to be sitting now is down here. Now, the thing is that if you have energies as much as 100 GeV, which you have in a thermal bath, if everything is hot as 100 GeV or more, there is no reason for you to sit at the minimum of the potential. You could actually be at the point of maximum symmetry. And it's expected that somewhere around this temperature, at higher temperatures, you're sitting up here. Lower temperatures, you fall down here. So that's, and after this time, you essentially have the standard model of particle physics working. Before this time, you have some weird phase of the universe, which we don't really know much about. But the standard model is anywhere downwards of here. Yes?
That it allowed everything to be in equilibrium from the beginning and throughout and so on. So how does that work with putting baryogenesis, where you put it? If you want baryogenesis to happen out of equilibrium.
But the fact that the universe is expanding put things out of equilibrium. So if you had exact equilibrium, then the universe wouldn't be expanding. It would be sitting in some constant. It's not even clear because, on the one hand, in general relativity, you cannot really have a static universe, a stable static universe. So it's really a good question that do we really have a concept of equilibrium in a gravitational system? So the inflation does do something for you. It makes the universe homogeneous, but it doesn't put it in thermodynamic or the full thermodynamic equilibrium. The part that's in least equilibrium is the gravitational part because, it's very hard to put gravity in thermal equilibrium in other things.
I thought one of the reasons we wanted inflation is that it allowed everything to happen in equilibrium right
before inflation. Well, right after inflation or before. But we don't really know what happens before inflation. But after inflation, the idea is that doesn't matter what is before inflation. If the inflationary paradigm is correct, after inflation, you have a homogeneous anisotropic universe, that is locally homogeneous anisotropic. It could happen. There is one thing that inflation does for us. It's make universe homogeneous. It homogenizes the universe. The equilibrium is a much stronger word. And I'm not ready to accept that inflation leads to equilibrium. So, and actually the thing that's weird is how you can have a homogeneous universe without equilibrium. And that's what one of the achievements of inflation. It can make the universe homogeneous without actually reaching full thermal equilibrium. But this is something probably you're gonna hear about more over the course of coming weeks and months. So, but the one thing is you don't never really have equilibrium. And for baryogenesis to work, for example, you need to be out of equilibrium. Now, cosmology, the fact that you have expansion of the universe, does give you that at some level. But you also need some extra physics. So just being out of equilibrium is not enough to give baryons, to get this amount of baryons. So from this temperature downwards, you have a good, we basically have a good handle of what should happen. And it's just from this point downward, it's less speculation and more calculation, which obviously I'm not going to do much of. But I can list a bunch of main events that happen afterwards, as far as the blackboard allows. So you have the so-called QCD phase transition. So you know of course that protons and neutrons are made out of quarks, right? Now quarks, we seem to think that at low energies quarks cannot be free because they interact so strongly they cannot, you cannot actually separate them from whatever they belong to. For example, if you have say three quarks in a proton, if I try to separate one of the quarks, the force, the energy keeps getting larger and larger, and eventually you form an anti-quark and another quark here. So you form actually virtual quarks that become real. And you can never actually have a free quark. You always form anti-quarks to dress these. And basically, whatever is left has zero color. The net color of whatever that is freely propagating is zero. Now, this is true at low energies. But at very high energies, it turns out that the strong coupling, the strong interaction, becomes weak. So this is a so-called asymptotic freedom. At high energies, the strong nuclear interaction becomes weak. And that's expected to happen somewhere around energies of 100 MeV, that you could actually have a free, the so-called quark-gluon plasma. Quarks and gluons, the interactions are weak enough that they can just freely propagate in the universe. Wow. Yeah. So this is almost how quark gluon plasma feels like, but a little bit hotter than this. Below this temperature, that's when the nuclear coupling becomes strong enough that you cannot have free quarks, so they actually bind together into nuclei. So after this time, you have nuclei. So before this, you have some nuclear goo that everything is in together. But then it actually condensed into these blobs of nuclei, protons and neutrons. So there are, at lower temperatures, you have other things happening. For example, neutrinos freeze out. And this is the mistake I made yesterday. I wasn't sure about the temperature for neutrino freeze out. So this is neutrinos are weakly coupled, so they actually freeze out pretty early in the history of universe. They actually freeze out around the temperature of an MeV. So I said a GeV yesterday. So this is more like an MeV. So at this point, after from this point onward, neutrinos go their own way, and the rest of the matter go their own way, and don't talk to each other. Then shortly after this, around 0.1 MeV, you have electron-positron. You have electron-positron annihilation. So this is what we discussed yesterday a little bit. Now, there is something interesting about thermodynamics in the early universe. And that's particularly this number that makes things a little bit peculiar, that there are lots and lots of photons for every baryon or lepton in the early universe. Well, I mean, when you have at temperatures larger than the masses of leptons or baryons, then you can thermally produce a lot of baryons and anti-baryons. So the numbers is comparable. But there is a small offset between baryons and anti-baryons, or leptons and anti-leptons. So at low temperatures, temperatures less than their mass, all of them will annihilate except for a little bit left over because of their small asymmetry. And since that leftover is small, so you have this small number which leads to some peculiar effects. For example, you would expect that because the mass of electrons and positrons is half an MeV, below temperatures of an MeV, you basically all electrons and positrons recombine, and you have nothing or very little electrons left. Now it turns out that you have lots and lots of photons, so the process that you have is electron positron going to gammas. Even though you have even if temperature of photons is very small, smaller than mass of electrons, this process can happen in both directions. Because in reality, you have a Planck spectrum. So if you have lots and lots of photons, even if the peak of this spectrum is less than the mass of so let's say this is 0.1 MeV. Even if the peak is less than the mass of electrons, there are a lot of photons. So this is the energy density of photons as a function of their momentum or energy. There are still a lot of photons in the tail which have energy less than or larger than 511 keV or 0.5 MeV. That can make this process go in both directions and keep electrons and positrons in thermal equilibrium. This does happen in every stage from this point onward, basically, because you have lots and lots of photons. Even if the temperature is less than the temperature you expect you should have thermal equilibrium, you are still in thermal equilibrium because of the things that happen to be. Because there are so many photons, there are a lot of them on the tail. This particularly here takes a while for electron positrons to annihilate because there are so many photons. Now, this is the slight side note, but it actually, this importance becomes clear a little bit later. One thing that follows from here, and something I mentioned yesterday as well, if you use energy conservation, basically dE plus pdV equal to zero, during the time that electrons and positrons annihilate, and this is a simple exercise, you can try to do it, this is a standard calculation, you can show that temperature of photons goes to basically 11/4 times temperature of photons during this process, because electrons and positrons go to photons. And the temperature of neutrinos doesn't change. So it's the same thing. This is 11/4 to the power of 1/3. And this has to do with the conservation of entropy, which is essentially this equation. Now, again, I'm not going to be able to do this for you, but this is an interesting calculation. It's a very simple one. So the next thing that's very interesting and important is actually one of the cornerstones of Big Bang cosmology is nucleosynthesis. So let's write it in a different color. So this happens. So basically, what happens is that. So up to this point, you have other than electron positrons that mostly annihilate, you have nuclei, protons, and neutrons in the universe. Now the thing is that it's a little bit energetically favorable for nuclei, neutrons, and protons to combine and make nucleons. I wanted to say nucleons. Sorry, this is. I guess these are different terminologies, or I think people call these hadrons as well. I don't know. Different communities have different terminologies. So either hadrons or nucleons. So these are protons and neutrons. Now, at low temperature, it's favorable for these guys to combine and make nuclei, like helium, like lithium, deuterium, all the nuclei that you see in the periodic table. And that's when the nucleosynthesis happens. So you basically, the temperature is low enough that you can make a lot of heavier elements. But in particular, the elements that you can make, you have enough time to make, is, what is the right color to use now? Is helium, deuterium, and lithium. A little bit of a lot of helium, basically 25% of mass of the baryons goes into helium. And very, very little of deuterium and lithium. And that's it. And this happens, again, around the temperature of 0.1 MeV. So from this point onwards, you basically don't have any free neutrons. Actually, neutrons also decay after some time into protons and electrons. But the only ones that survive are the ones that are in helium nuclei. So from this point onwards, you just have nuclei instead of nucleons or hadrons. And this is a very important part of Big Bang cosmology, because this was actually the first time, this was the basis of prediction for cosmic microwave background. So George Gamow, so the fact that we have a lot of helium in the universe, this was known for a long time, actually, because you can, for example, look at Sun, and you can see that a good fraction of its mass is in helium. Actually, that's where the word comes from, helios, which is sun in Greek. So that was the first time that, is that true? Anybody Greek here? Okay, is it helios sun? Okay, good. Don't make a fool of myself. So, so this was known for a long time, since early 20th century, that there's a lot of mass of the sun is in helium. And what George Gamow did was to, based on this Big Bang cosmology picture, of course, he didn't have a full picture of all this, but for most of this, because in, most of this happened in thermal equilibrium, or close to thermal equilibrium. So to actually do the nucleosynthesis part, you don't really need to know most of what's happening before, because all that you care is that the universe had some temperature, and everything is in thermal equilibrium. And he figured out that there must be a photon temperature that leads to the production of helium to the amount that we see it in the early universe. And that was basically the first prediction for this photon bath, for the photons that essentially keep the universe in thermal equilibrium for most of its, for a big part of its history. So, of course, this temperature is 0.1 MeV at this time. But then these photons will be redshifted as the universe expands, so we're not going to see photons of this temperature right now. We're going to see some much smaller temperature. And let's see. So this is something, it's not obvious to me how this calculation follows through. But what Gamow showed that these photons today must have a temperature of 10 to the minus 4, or roughly 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. because the universe has expanded since then. Basically, the nuclear the density that you had here was much higher, so the universe must expand to reach the density comparable to now. Now, what Kamov showed is that when that amount of expansion happens, so you have density comparable to today's density, then the temperature of those photons, the leftover photons, must be this much. So this was the first prediction for cosmic microwave background before we knew that there was this picture of a hot early universe. But anyway, so that right now, this is one of the important predictions of cosmology, that you can go look in the stars, see how much helium, deuterium, and lithium there is. And with some small discrepancy, except for some small, with exception of some small discrepancies, this is the same amount that you predict from this picture of early universe. There are a few free parameters. You need to, so these do depend on cosmological parameters like Hubble constant and omega matter and this ratio, omega baryon, for example. But still, everything seems to be more or less consistent. So this is one of the successes of Big Bang cosmology, to predict how much of these elements you have. Of course, we don't form heavier elements, it turns out. Can any of you tell you where we form heavier elements? Okay, good. So, I mean, I guess it wasn't that hard of a question, but anyway, it turns out that these elements are made in early universe, and everything else you form it in supernovae. It starts up. Yes.
How do people come across that 10 to the minus 10 figure for the ratio of particles to photons? Is that actually observed?
It is actually. So you can actually calculate this number. So this is essentially the density of baryons divided by the mass of baryons divided by the density, by the number density of photons, basically. So number of density of photons is essentially temperature cubed. And this you actually observe today. So this 10 to the minus 4 electron volt is 3 Kelvin, which is observed. So, but of what Gamow predicted, of course, at Gamow's time, this wasn't observed. So he predicted that T gamma must be around 3 Kelvin for things to work. Rho baryon divided by M baryon. M baryon is, of course, proton's mas. We know what that is. That's about the GeV. Rho baryon, at early times, you didn't know it exactly. But it's really omega baryon times the critical density of the universe. Critical density you know from Hubble constant. And omega baryon, people in the early times assumed this is something of order 1. Right now, we know it's really more like 0.04. But this is really how you calculate this. So this is photon temperature. This is 3 Kelvin. This is 1 GeV mass of proton. And this is density of baryon, which is 0.04 times the critical density. This is from Hubble constant, basically. From Hubble constant, you know what critical density is. That's just integral of over the Planck function. So, yeah. Or, yeah, exact. So this is integral of p squared dp divided by e to the p divided by p minus 1. Right. So this is the Bose-Einstein distribution. This integral over the full phase space gives you a spatial density. OK, good. Yes.
The chart also the freeze-out of dark matter.
Yeah, good, good. I had it on my table somewhere, but I missed it. So the problem with dark matter, though, I'm looking for a chart. The problem with dark matter is we don't really know what it is. But if it is something like the problem that you had yesterday, it's weakly interacting massive particle. Its mass is about 100 GeV, so its freeze-out is somewhere between 100 to 10. GeV-ish. So you're going to have dark matter freeze out. freeze out somewhere here. So this, but this depends on the mass of dark matter, but it's somewhere around 10 GeV. It could be one or two orders of magnitude higher or lower, depending on what is the actual mass of what the dark matter particle is and what are the interactions. So it's kind of a very complicated figure. But yeah, so that was a very good point. Thanks, David. So there isn't much room left there to put more processes, but we happen to live right at the bottom here. Okay? So the temperature right now, as I said, is 10 to the minus 4 electron volt. And I said these are all inversely proportional. These temperatures are inversely proportional to redshift. So let's see. We are here. Okay. Now, there are two important steps that I wanted to fit in between those nucleosynthesis and now. So let's see how much I can, how small I can write. Okay. So you have recombination, now of course, here, up to here, we have nuclei before this time. Can you guess what happens, what we have after recombination? Atoms, exactly. So you have nuclei and electrons, of course, here at this point. So I can say nuclei plus electrons. And of course, you have neutrinos as well. They don't care much about the rest of the universe, but they are there. Recombination, the temperature of the universe is low enough where electrons and protons or other nuclei can recombine, make atoms. The universe becomes neutral. And that happens around 0.3 electron volt. Now, the reason this happens at such a low temperature, now you know the excitation energy of hydrogen atom is 13.6 electron volt, right? But the recombination happens at 0.3 electron volt. And the reason is what I told you before, actually told you this about electron positrons, but you could also imagine the same process for, so let me erase this, for recombination. So you have electrons and protons that combine to make hydrogen atom plus a photon. Right. So it turns out that you would think that as the temperature falls below 13.6 electron volt, essentially all the electrons and protons recombine to make hydrogen atoms and gammas and then emit some photons. But it happens that even at much lower temperatures, you can have photons colliding with hydrogen atom, ionize them, and make electron protons. And that's because there are so many more photons than there are hydrogen atoms. So even when the temperature of photon is low, where most of photons cannot ionize hydrogen atom, there is a small fraction of photons that can because they happen to sit in the tail. But then, since there are so many of them, those are enough to ionize hydrogen to make electron protons. And this is all, you can see all of this in the thermal equilibrium. So I'm going to write an equation for you. Which you can try to derive. It's actually very easy to derive it. So maybe I should add that as a homework. It's called Saha equation. And essentially, it tells you that the fraction of ionized electrons, or so you have some electrons are in hydrogen atoms, but the rest of them are ionized. So this is the ionized fraction. the fraction of ionized electrons divided by 1 minus xe, so this xe is the same thing, it's roughly n gamma divided by n baryons. This is the number, the inverse of the number I had there, times m electron divided by temperature to the 3 halves, times exponential of minus 13.6 electron volt divided by t. So you can derive this. So let's see. Maybe we can leave this as a homework. That you can derive this from assuming that the chemical potential for electrons plus chemical potential for protons is equal to chemical potential for hydrogen atoms. And this basically comes from putting this this being in thermal equilibrium. If you have a process that is in thermal equilibrium, a chemical process that is in thermal equilibrium, it means that the sum of the chemical potentials on the two sides must be the same. For photons, there is no chemical potential. So this is the equation. And just using Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac distribution for non-relativistic particles, you can actually get from here to here, assuming that everything is in thermal equilibrium. And this is a big number. This is 10 to the 10. This is what keeps Kxe large until very light time, until temperature of 0.3 electron volts. So if you solve this equation, find where Xe is a half, where half of electrons become neutral, then you find something like 0.3 electron volts. And this is around redshift of 1,000. So let me write this down somewhere. Yes.
But I thought the definition of freeze out was that the particles can no longer interact with each other.
Yes.
So the expansion of the universe.
Good.
But then after freeze out, you have all this recombination and atom formation. So isn't that
freeze out of what? I mean, this is neutrino freeze out. After this, neutrinos don't see anything else.
No, but the protons and electrons haven't frozen out yet.
Not really. No, protons and electrons haven't frozen out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right. So now, if something actually freezes out, then it doesn't see anything else. For example, what happens right after recombination, and I don't have room to put it down, but it does happen, is so-called last scattering, that photons don't see anything else. And the reason is that the cross-section of an electron with free photons is much larger than the cross section of smaller than the cross section of a hydrogen atom. So as soon as the electrons combine with protons and make hydrogen atoms, photons can travel freely in the universe. So essentially, you have the process of Thomson scattering for free electrons. But as soon as the electrons combine with photons, there is no Thomson scattering, and photons freeze out basically at this point. So before that, they are not frozen out. So yeah, that's right. So you're exactly right. If something freezes out, it doesn't affect anything. And that happens for photons right after this. So the last slice that is actually the slice we know the most about, yes.
That explanatory there, is that 13.6 eV or 13 GeV?
It's 13.6 eV.
Okay.
So that's the ionization energy of hydrogen atom, right? Yes. A 100 MeV. No, sorry. For nucleosynthesis, you have point. That's right. So 100 keV.
So that's
a billion Kelvin. Is that similar to the temperature of the sun? I think that's more than the temperature of the sun.
It sounds really hot to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's 10 to the 5, the temperature of the sun.
Mm-hmm. That's something. Four orders of
magnitude. But the sun does nucleosynthesis, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always creating helium and all that stuff.
No, you're
that's
not.
Right.
You're not creating matter.
You're not creating. You're
that's what nucleosynthesis is you grab two protons and you make a helium.
Yes. Oh, you're.
So okay. So the temperature of the sun is 15 million Kelvin, which is.
If the temperature of the sun gets hot enough, there's photodisintegration, which is exactly the opposite of nucleosynthesis. So yeah, that makes sense. They're of the right order. Like things are going on.
It depends on that.
But you see, one thing which I have in mind, the synthesis in sun happens over a billion-year time scale. This happens over a bunch of
it. So the sun being, it can still be 100, well, 200 times less.
It does happen, but much, much slower. And of course, there is a density. So it's not just the temperature, density also matters. Okay, good, perfect. Very probing questions. So the last part I have to add is, so it was very interesting, but the last part I have to add is a structure formation. And this is the part that we know the most about, but is also the messiest. This is the only part where the inhomogeneities are actually important and play a big role. So we put something else around it. So what happens is that you do have inflation does have some quantum fluctuations. Now, inflation may not be the correct theory of the universe, but whatever that replaces the inflation must have some fluctuations. Inflation itself has some quantum fluctuations. And they are existent all the way through these processes. But they are small and they don't do anything. Now, around the same time that recombination happens, you also have matter, this dark matter, dominating the density of the universe. So you have matter radiation equality. And after that, it turns out that the structures can actually grow in the universe. So before this time, even if you had some perturbation, it didn't evolve much because you had basically this baryon photon fluid, which has a very large speed of sound. So you just basically have sound waves in the baryon photon fluid. Dark matter doesn't see baryons, basically, because it's frozen out after this time. But because most of the density of the universe is still in photons, and even if there are some perturbations in dark matter, they couldn't do much. It turns out that after matter dominates everything, dominates the density of the universe, the fluctuations in matter density can grow. And they can actually form a structures. So now let's make that the last thing to go over in detail. I can write it here. So remember this A versus T diagram, or I guess maybe I never plotted it, but I had a table which described, for in the matter era, A goes as T to the 2/3. I can write, if let's say make it logarithmic plot. So this is a line, T to the 2/3. Now, I told you that observations tell us omega k is almost exactly 0 to 1% accuracy. So there is very little curvature in the universe. So in matter era, if you forget about dark energy, which happens to be important, right around the same time, right about now, but all the time before, basically from recombination or from matter equality, to right about now, you have only matter, you have only dark matter, which dominates the density of the universe, and A goes as T to the 2/3. Now, the thing that's interesting about these fluctuations is that even though on average omega k is 0, the fact that there are fluctuations in the universe means that omega k in some regions could be positive and some regions could be negative. So the Friedman equation that you had even though this term is on average zero, if there are some regions that it could be slightly positive and some regions where it could be slightly negative. What that means is that this actually can deviate from t to the 2/3. In some region, it actually goes higher. And in some region, it goes lower. And it turns out in regions that it goes lower, it eventually turns around and recollapses. That you can see by looking at this equation, that if k is negative, there is a region where there is a point where h becomes, if k is positive, there is a point where h can be 0. Basically, this thing goes down as 1 over a cubed. If this thing goes down as 1 over a squared, so at early times, this is negligible. But as late times, these two become comparable, and h becomes 0. So this is when the structures, the regions that so-called overdense regions of the universe, they actually recollapse and form a structure. So this is where you form galaxies, stars, etc. Those happen in the regions of a universe where k is slightly positive, and this goes, this can. So the expansion is slightly slower, but eventually it slows down, it stops, and then recollapses. So, and everything seems to roughly match here. So what you have is that the ratio of this term to this term grows as a. So roughly, you could write down delta rho over rho. This is very approximate. But the overdensity, so there are regions that are slightly overdense. So those are regions where k is slightly positive. And regions that are slightly underdense, those are regions that are k is slightly negative. And the regions that are overdense or underdense, at least early on, their overdensity grows as a. Because the ratio of this term to this term grows as a. So if you start with some fluctuations that are of order 10 to the minus 4, say just before recombination, then they are of order 1 now. And that basically means that you're forming galaxies and stars right around now. So this is a very rough calculation there. But this is essentially the gist of a structure formation, that you have at the time of, so roughly at z equal to 10 to the 4, you have delta of order 10 to the minus 4. And this is what you also see in the cosmic microwave background. You see anisotropies of order 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 5. But then delta grows as proportional to A. So it's of order 1 at redshift of around 1, basically. Yes? First of all, that's an observational fact, right now. Now, then the rest is up to the theory, whether you believe the theory of inflation or whatever other theory there is. But all these theory, the successful ones, they have a process built into them to generate the fluctuations of this size. Now, you have to tune the parameters of the theories to make fluctuations this big.
Okay, so this isn't well explained. There's no...
But yeah, I mean, this is, we have mechanisms, but, I mean, so you have one model to only explain one number, essentially, so... Well, so the thing that's amazing about inflation is that you have one model that can explain more than one, just this number as well as the horizon problem, which I explained before. So there's something that's interesting about inflation that maybe there's one model that can explain more than one fact. But the model is, people argue, is fine-tuned. So, but that's not what I'm going to talk about. Yeah. That's going to be a lot of what you're going to hear about on cosmology later, maybe in a couple of weeks or so. But so that's the challenge. So, but having a well-motivated theory of the early universe to give you 10 to the minus 4 or 10 to the minus 5, that's the challenge that you need to, that early universe or basically fundamental physical model, either a string theory or loop quantum gravity or somebody who claims to understand the physics in the early universe, that should tell you, that model should explain this. But then if you assume this, then from this point on, everything is well understood. This, from this point on, structures grow as A. That gives you, tell you order of one fluctuation right now. And when I say order of one, that basically means that it's going to go around and collapse, or stop and collapse. That means that you form galaxies at around this point. Yes? Well, that's kind of this recombination thing. Yeah, I didn't mention. Yeah, so this is right after recombination is when photons can travel freely. So I don't know. I think I don't really have much room here. But let's put it last scattering surface here. So this is called LSS. Essentially, what happens is that right after all the electrons recombine with protons, as I said, for the cross section of interacting with photons drops down significantly, so all photons can travel freely. And so when you look back into the early universe, that is the surface that you're going to see. Because beyond that, the cross section is very high, the universe is opaque. After that, the universe is transparent. And that point is exactly defined by when recombination happens. And that's what you're going to see. The photons that you see in the cosmic microwave background have this temperature. The last time they scattered off matter was at this point, was around recombination. Yes?
So, do we have any observation proof of what happened before that in any sense?
Well, the one thing that we are pretty confident of is this nuclear synthesis. But we don't really see anything directly. So in terms of actually traditional astronomy, the universe is opaque before that point. So it's like finding out what's behind that ceiling or what's behind that wall. So you don't really see things. You might have indirect inferences. And that would be, so there's much less information that you would expect in traditional astronomy. So you have few numbers. The most significant ones are these abundances of light elements, helium, deuterium, lithium, and such. If you ever manage to see neutrinos, cosmological neutrinos, and the temperature of neutrinos is comparable to the temperature of CMB, it's slightly lower. There is no experiment, no proposal in the foreseeable future for seeing cosmic neutrinos. Technology just isn't there. If we ever manage to see them, they're going to tell us something a little bit more about an earlier phase. If we ever manage to see gravitational waves, some people claim that they come generated in inflation, they can go very far back. If we ever manage to see dark matter, they go also far back. But of course, so all of those are hypothetical. We haven't seen any of them. But the problem is that everything happens in thermal equilibrium here. So after they recombine and form nucleon, basically all the memory of what was before is gone because everything is in thermal equilibrium. And so you don't really, so all that, from this point on, all you care about is the temperature of the universe. And whatever happens before that, we don't really know. Yeah, kind of, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess you could say that. Well, we have other ways of probing these energies. Energies, you can probe these energies in colliders. It's not the same thing exactly, but of course, if you say in LHC, you can, or in even other older versions of these accelerators, you could achieve energies all the way to a TeV. So you could probe the same kind of physics, more or less. Not everything. For example, dark matter, because it's so weakly coupled, it seems that you haven't been able to make them in colliders, but there are independent ways of approaching this, say in colliders. Maybe neutron stars would tell us something about them because they have very high densities. Yes?
What do you actually mean by the quark quantum
mean that if you actually have the quarks and they propagate, it's not in a bound state with other quarks?
Yes, they just propagate freely.
Because I mean, if this is at 100 MeV, this is, you know, we can easily do this in any accelerator. And just
yes, you can. And that is done. So there's.
But I mean, you don't see single quarks going along in my accelerator.
No, you do. I mean, you don't see it in large distances. You can make regions that are small, but the temperature is high enough, they are energetic enough, where essentially you have free quarks. And this is a so-called, I mean, so what people call asymptotic freedom, that was first basically proved this way, that if you look at collisions of hadrons at very high energies, it's like collisions of individual quarks.
But we still don't see the individual quarks.
But it depends on what you mean by see.
I mean literally see.
Well, yeah, so the photons cannot get out to us from them. But you can, that there are, so there's, for example, there's this so-called Rick collider somewhere in Brookhaven. I forgot what it stands for. But also LHC is supposed, one of the phrases is supposed to do, basically you hit heavy nuclei. And in some small region, you have high enough temperature and high enough density that you have essentially a quark gluon plasma.
If I went back in time, in that time, and I looked at my quark gluon plasma, yeah. Would I actually see a single quark zooming around? And I could say,
but again, it depends on what you mean by C, but yes.
Would I measure a fractional charge?
Yeah. No, but you see, the point is, that's the proposal of this.
Okay.
The coupling of the coupling constant for for a strong interaction, it actually drops with energy. So at right now, it's, I don't remember what it is, it's of order one or larger. But as you go to high energies, the coupling constant drops. So at high energies, the GS strong becomes small. So basically, everything becomes weakly coupled, becomes like electromagnetism in a sense, at high energies. And so you can think of basically gases or weakly interacting gases at very high energy. So that seems to be consistent at least. I don't know. Of course, what you mean by seeing something, that could be a controversial question. Okay, so this is it. I think I should end. I've gone over. This is my last day, so next week you're going to have Piranha telling you about all the exciting physics of a cosmic microwave background. I'm going to see you again this afternoon for these short presentations. And of course, if you ever visit the Arbit building, I'll be around. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.